Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 16th of February. I'm Phil Carroll.
I'm Kevin Hornsby with a cold.
And I'm Charles Archer, healthy and fit as a fiddle.
I was going to ask how everyone is, but I got that on the introduction there. That's nice. So what's up, Kev? I thought it might have been travel related, but obviously you said something about the kids having the lurgy.
No, the kids have had fever now for a few days, well, a week probably. They keep getting a bit better and want to go out and play and then come back again feeling crap again. So yeah, I've been praying all week. I didn't get it, and then sort of yesterday I was feeling crap and then started sneezing a lot, and then yeah. Now yeah. I just feel like, you know, when you feel like your head's filling with
fluid, yeah,
not or whatever it happens to be, that's how it feels right now. So I've had a couple of big tablets.
Hot toddies, mate. Get some lemon and whiskey inside. Yeah.
Do you ever try to like plan your children's sicknesses around like major events? Because like for me, like I've learned, start of December, I take all three of them. We go to this big soft play by the beach. It's covered in germs. The snotty children's sickness. And I know they're going to get ill, and then they get over it, you know, a week or two before Christmas, and then Christmas is always wonderful. Whether you try and chance it, they're always sick on the special days. You've got to plan it ahead, don't you?
Yeah, that's called herd immunity, isn't it, really, effectively? We will give you the sickness, you'll get over it, and then all will be good. My oldest one here, she used to get sick quite regularly in the winter, and it was quite difficult for her to get over it. So we were trying to avoid it, but in the end, you can't avoid it. You know, it's like you just have to let it happen. And she's sick, and then
I was looking at some. I was using one of them nasal sprays. You know, that you're meant to put in that prevents it. Because like you see people when they go on a flight, they take a couple of squirts of this nasal spray. You know, because it's meant to kill all the germs that sit in your nasal cavity. But it said on the packaging, "Do not inhale." I'm thinking, well, what is this about? How can you have a nasal spray, and you don't inhale it? Just no, bizarre. Yes.
No, so blow it up your nose, and then
just leave it. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm 90% confident that for all colds and chills, the only thing you need is paracetamol, the cheapest thing that comes from Tesco, and everything else is a waste of money and time. You just have to be miserable for a few
weeks. But how much of that do you reckon is a placebo? Like you take a couple before bed and you think, oh yeah, that's worked wonders. I feel better or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Do you think there's a placebo effect?
There must be a massive placebo effect there as well. But, you know, I think often, you know, I'm trying to think of the words. Like, we go back 100 years and the kind of sicknesses that people got and died from all the time is awful. And now the only thing we really have, unless you get something serious, is a common cold. And everything else is just kind of like one or two day thing. It doesn't really matter. Yeah.
And if you have a common cold, if you overdose yourself on vitamin C, whiskey with hot water, ginger, and any other spices you think are going to help you, then normally it works.
Vitamin D is good as well, because obviously that's in a country like the UK where we get very little sun in the winter, because this obviously you normally get your amounts through the sun. I mean, you'd be fine for you out there in Egypt, Kev, because you get a lot of sun all year round. But for those who don't, vitamin D is really good for the immune system. But the other thing I've started doing is cold showers for a minute, absolutely ice cold, and you come out of them feeling absolutely just, honestly, it's just like a high. And apparently that has really good health benefits for your immune system, the way that it's like cell regrowth and generation. It's painful to do it initially, but once you get into it,
I was going to say, the first few seconds, halas, my hand's on the control room straight back up to warm water. It's not happening even 5 seconds. Never mind.
So what people are going to take away from this, right? You've got to sit in a cold shower, freezing cold. You've got to have a glass of whiskey with a bit of hot water. Pour your vitamin D sachet in and swirl it around.
There you go.
Down it, come out, and you'll feel a lot better.
Well, it's better than, let's move on to some of the news. I mean, it's better than injecting yourself with bleach, which is one of the things that Trump said during COVID anyway. But I mean, let's have a look at the news. That the big dominating headlines this week was obviously, you know, a few executive orders signed. Another week goes by, lots more tariffs from Trump this week with the tariff on steel and aluminium. The UK government, through the Trade Minister Douglas Alexander, stated that there will be no knee-jerk reaction to the US steel and aluminium tariffs, promised a clear-headed response instead. UK Steel described these tariffs as a devastating blow to the industry. I mean, and then there's obviously the EU is sort of weighing up where, you know, whether there's going to be any trade Trump tariffs on any of the cars and exports. But I did a bit of digging into this just to see what the current, you know, EU imposing of tariffs are. And they actually put on a 10% tariff on cars imported from the US. And that, you know, applies to obviously finished vehicles, while parts on them are subject to tariffs. I think it's around 3.5 to 4%. But what I found that, like, actually, if you look at the US compared to US tariffs, the US charges only a 2.5% tariff on equivalent. So right now, the EU tariffs on US cars are significantly higher. I mean, what do you make of that? Is it been that we've punished the US before they've punished us?
I mean, my personal perspective on the cars is that the US makes massive cars that aren't suitable for Europe or the UK. So there's is I'm not even sure it's a money thing. It's say we don't want them on the road. And that's not to say that they're fine in the US, where the roads are massive and it's been built for the age of the car. But you see these massive monster trucks driving down the road anywhere in Europe. They don't fit in here, they don't belong here. They're putting a tariff on it. If you want to have it, then you should pay more for it. But all of these tariffs, I mean, the aluminium and steel ones that go into effect, I think, on the 4th of March. So, like all of them, is it just bluster tactics? You know, just a negotiation and, you know, behind the scenes, we're going to get something different by the time we get there. I think it, you know, w the tariffs are going to be put in place, then they're not, then they're going to be delayed, then they're going to come back. We've just seen it again and again and again. So, whether we actually have them in a few months' time, I'm not sure.
That's a good point. I've not really thought of it like that, but you're absolutely right. Some of these big, like Ford trucks, like the F-150 and Raptors, and all these big Hummers and things like that, they're just far too big for UK roads. I mean, some of the parking spaces are designed for 1980s vehicles right now. You know, you try putting in a
Already
truck
they're too big,
already,
you
they're too,
know?
yeah,
Yeah,
exactly,
yeah.
exactly that. So, what do we make of the whole UK, sorry, the Ukraine Russia conflict? You know, we've obviously seen President Trump that he's had already started negotiations to end the war in Ukraine with President Putin. Apparently, there's going to be a meeting planned at some point. Obviously, there's also a meeting going on right now as we speak in Munich as well. You know, he's basically Zelensky's reaction to that. He's made it very clear that any talks about Ukraine's future without Ukraine's direct involvement are just completely unacceptable and dangerous. And that, you know, excluding Ukraine from negotiations could set a precedent. But do we think that Trump is actually going to be able to negotiate the end to the Ukraine war without affecting or upsetting anybody, you know, the sort of tri-party agreement?
Well, it's impossible to not upset anybody. Someone's going to lose, and it's going to be Ukraine in terms of territory. I think that's kind of inevitable. The problem is, obviously, you don't actually know what Trump wants. Is this a plan to get Europe to pay more for defense, for example? You know, I do think that this war needs to end. It needs to end now. The problem is, what kind of peace can you negotiate if Ukraine gives up territory or whatever else, where Russia doesn't just wait 5 years and then attack again? That's the problem. What kind of peace guarantee can you create where the Ukrainians suck it up? Because there's no point from that country's point of view signing a peace deal or accepting a peace deal if they think that Russia is going to attack again. And that's the crux of it. How do you guarantee that peace is going to be lasting?
What do we make of his attitude towards Europe as well? Because I mean, the front page of the paper I've got here today says 1949 deal to protect Europe from the war is history. Trump's message to shocked world leaders, as panic and disbelief in Europe as the US president signals major shift in security guarantees that have kept peace on continent for 80 years. You know, we're going to see a disbandment of NATO and. You know, we've seen the former UK defence official caution Europe has disarmed itself. What do we make? Is this just sort of, you know, the usual rhetoric around it, or do you think there is some truth in this?
Trump has always wanted European countries to up their defense spending, not like on pensions, their real defense spending, to 2.5% of GDP. Like, that's not an unreasonable demand, and they've just chosen not to do it again and again. Is it fair for America to pay for the defense of the entire Western world? No. And therefore, you know, is he blustering potentially, or does he just want countries to just commit to that 2.5% and then he'll be fine? I think that's probably the answer. Kev, what are your thoughts?
I think the whole thing is part of the great American reset. They have to reset. You know, they've gone down a rabbit hole, which has got them a incredible amounts of debt, and partly because they've just been, ah yes, we'll fund that. Ah yes, we'll fund that. Ah, yes, we will have the biggest army in the world, or not necessarily the biggest, but the most effective army in the world,
And they've
and
got
we will
four
have
of them.
we will have an advantage in the world because of these things. And I think Trump's saying, yeah, we're going to have the advantage anyway, but pay for it. So I think an awful lot of what the world has accepted as whatever charity help assistance from the US is going to stop. And these countries are going to get them, going to have problems because they're going to have to fund them themselves. Even here in Egypt, because the Camp David Accord basically means that the US pays Egypt $1 billion a year for help with its defense. And that same accord basically says, yeah, we'll help Israel as much as physically possible. So are these things going to continue? Is Trump going to keep doing these things? Now he wants to buy Gaza and turn it into
The
the
Riviera of the Middle
Mediterranean.
East, yeah, as he
Yeah, I
said.
wouldn't mind. I mean, imagine they call it the Trump Strip.
It's the Riviera of the Mediterranean. Yeah, everybody forgets Gaza is on the Med, so it's on the Mediterranean coast. So, I mean, it's an absolutely ridiculous proposal as far as I'm concerned. But you cannot just ethnically cleanse a group of people and say off you go wherever you want to go. It just doesn't work. The whole thing is chaos. Now, the question I pose is, is this chaos being caused deliberately because effectively they need to unsettle everything so that they can, usher in the big reset, which is, we've seen it in gold now over the last period of time. I believe we're going to see it in all the metals. Silver now is getting absolutely ridiculous in terms of its ratio, 90 to 1 or whatever it is. So, we're in a time where, I said to somebody this week, I said, I wish I just bought my assets in gold a year ago or 2 years ago because you'd be very nicely up. And I think that's only the beginning. I think, we're in a reset and something physical, something real that can be bartered and used to buy real other assets is going to be gold and silver again.
That's it. I've got a small, I say a small, a medium collection of 1 ounce gold coins from the Royal Mint, physical coins, right? Kind of like, in case of financial collapse and everything becomes worthless. And I was just thinking the other day, I was spinning one in my hand, and I was like, I bought this for the equivalent of $1,400 9 years ago, and now it's worth double. But the coin itself hasn't changed. It's just sat in a drawer in my desk for years, It's crazy that,
It's crazy. Same with silver, really. Silver's had a really good run of late as well. Like, I remember buying it during the beginning of lockdown, sort of like late 19, early 20s. And since then, and that was sort of, as Kev said last week, the coins were probably around 18 to £20. You go on the Royal Mint now or any bullion site and try and buy a 1 ounce Canadian silver maple or a Britannia or an eagle or something like that. You're looking at £38 plus VAT because you got your 20. So you're looking at £42 to £45 for a single 1 ounce silver coin. Same with gold. It's really hard to actually get any physical at the
Come to
moment.
Egypt, there's no VAT on silver.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I mean, let's move on to our first guest this week. Delighted to be joined by Colin Bird, Executive Chairman of Bezant Resources. Welcome back to the podcast, Colin.
Thank you, Phil. That's nice of you. Nice to be back. Good to be back.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we saw the recent news that Bezant has successfully completed ore sorting optimization for copper gold ore at the Hope and Gorab project in Namibia. The optimization, based on fresh drill core and historical data, exceeded grade and recovery targets, supporting the financial model's projection of capital payback within 20 months of full-scale production. Key results include an upgraded feed grade of up to 2.95% copper above the required 2.4%, enhanced gold and silver credits, and a high proportion of chalcocite in fines, which improves mill feed quality and capacity efficiency. Ore sorting tests using conductivity, XRF, and color sensors effectively separated high-density sulfide-rich ore from waste, revealing potential for further copper recovery optimization. Silver grade significantly outperformed financial model assumptions, returning an average grade of 31 grams per ton of silver. Colin, you highlighted the positive impact on project economics and environmental efficiency, with further improvements in copper recovery expected. The study indicates that actual run-of-mine grades may exceed current projections, with additional optimization potentially increasing recoverable copper from what is currently classified as waste. Sounds like a great optimization exercise, Colin.
Absolutely. You don't find at our level that you get the opportunity to go to absolute full-scale pilot testing, which is what we did. Steinhardt was very, very helpful. We managed to get use of a machine of theirs, which would be similar to the machine that we use. And we thought, well, look, we've got a model, we've got a financial model, been developed by laboratory work. We'll go the whole log and we'll do a pilot scale testing. And so that's just what we did. And you've got the figures, and so in your little dissertation there, you said a lot of things, and you revealed a lot of figures. But I think the key thing here is the fact that sometimes in the old days they used to sort of have a set of ladies either side of the conveyor belt throwing off the waste or throwing off the ore, which was whichever was the most appropriate, and then you used to try and screen out the fraction which you got the best grade. So in our screening, and we decided that, or Steinhardt decided that their machine would work better at anything above 19 mil. So when we screened, about 23, 25% of it was fines. But the good news is that those fines were chalcocite. Now, chalcocite is copper sulfide, contains around about 80% copper, 79.9% copper. So when you think about it, what we don't mention there is the fact that it was like, what's the best way? It was like mousseline, it was like cornflakes. So we can imagine when that goes to the mill, it'll go through like salt, it'll go through in no time at all, liberating 80% of copper. So your mass replacement going through the mill is almost negative, and you're receiving 80% copper value from it. And most importantly, though, is that, as you know, the plant we probably intend using is rated at around about 184,000 tons per annum. We get 100,000 tons of these fines, and these fines are high-grade chalcocite. So that was a major, major plus, and quite frankly, a very, very pleasant surprise. What was the net effect of that? Was, of course, reducing the grade of the material what went to the ore sorter, and then we got a nice upgrade on that as well. So that's good. We screened out a nice grade, so that material hasn't got to go to the ore sorter. That will just be parked, and we just put on the lorry and turn across there, and there's 100,000 tons of it. So really, that's around about 20, 25% of the actual mine material, 23, 25%. So it's actually a splendid result. And we haven't said much about gold and silver before. We always told the market that we expected a good gold contribution. We were a little sort of reticent to talk about gold because not all the ores were assayed for gold. And so the population to get the specific resource was deficient in every hole, if you like, being assayed for gold in the old days. And the ones that we drilled were assayed for gold. So again, that was a nice result, and just verify the model. The silver, well, really exceeded expectations. And again, a few years ago, you wouldn't have been much bothered about silver, but the projections for silver are pretty positive all around. And so that is a valuable addition. And so really, if you'd start talking copper equivalent between copper and silver there, you've got a good 1% copper equivalent. And if you look at so that working costs are totally covered by copper, by gold and silver. And so the copper comes for free, or vice versa, whichever way you want it. So that was a splendid bit of test work and came out better than we expected in all fronts, and driven by the fact that the fines contained a lot of gold. And it's the best gold chalcocite, copper sulfide, and which runs at 80% and almost presented itself in an agglomerated form, perfect to put into a mill. If you'd have wanted to write the result before you did the tests, it wouldn't be much different to this, if you'd have done a wish list.
I guess if you're going to have chalcocite and that very high copper content and its high friability, it also means that the CapEx, the OpEx of whatever plant you choose to use, it's going to the wear and tear is going to be much, much lower as well. Presumably, it's
Oh
going to
yeah,
be
like I
cheaper to put
say,
it through too.
absolutely. It'll go through the mill like a dose of salts, absolutely, and liberate a lot of copper.
I guess if you've got gold and silver credits as well, can you just talk me through that quickly? How you plan to liberate the gold and silver separately from the copper?
Well, we won't. They will be part of the concentrate. If you go back 10, 15 years ago, you didn't get paid, but now you get paid for both metals. But it will be in the bulk. It'll be in the bulk concentrate alongside the copper. So you don't actually need to
You don't need
separate
to
it.
separate it. Oh,
You don't
that
need to
makes no
separate it.
expensive sort of separation or processing
That's all
costs
I was
No,
thinking.
no.
Perfect.
They what they do, they knock off 1 gram, and then the payability is 94% of the remaining gold. and silver. I can't quite remember, but there's also a formula for that. So no, they're both payable and they're part of the concentrate. What we are thinking about, quite frankly, is that we do mention in that news release that there's copper in the waste. So, and that's generally attached to the quartz side. And we've seen a cross-cutting layers where they're very iron and gold. And so as the project goes along, if we find that there's a definitive gold reef, that we in actual fact might actually put at an optimum place in the processing circuit, one or more of these Falcon concentrators, Nelson concentrators, because if it's in nugget form, we'll actually be able to, extract physical gold. And then, of course, the payability, well, there'll be more of it for a start, and the payability is much higher because it's not in concentrate form, it's in gold form, gold doré. So, but that's along the line, and it's totally unnecessary at the moment to do that because the big question is what grade can you get from ore sorting, screening and ore sorting? What grade can you get to supply any the proposed plan? And what's the input output compared to the input? And then, how much of this chalcocite can you screen out? And the chalcocite, really, of every single sort of figure that you get from that test, the one to get really excited about is the chalcocite, which is a lot of it, 23%-ish. And very high-grade copper, of course, the chalcocite is.
Well, you're talking about payback of capital in less than 20 months based on these results. It makes it quite attractive for financing. I guess the idea is we want to get financing and get producing this year potentially. Can you comment on a timeline, or are you still looking at options at the moment?
Oh, I'm not allowed to comment on timelines. That's a no-no in these podcasts.
No.
But
Don't answer it, Colin. Don't
sorry.
let him lead you down the path.
No,
Don't
I'm not going to
answer it.
let
He
him
said,
lead me.
but
No, I'm
he
not
was
going to
going to
fall
say words.
for it at the moment.
No, that's fair enough.
No,
That's
no.
fair enough.
No,
I won't put the words in your mouth,
But just
but.
talk us through, I mean, forget the timeline for a minute, but just talk us through how you arrived at that 20-month period, the payback of capital, and obviously you've done studies, you've done the mineralization, first 3 years of production would cover that. So just talk us through how you arrived at that number, Colin.
Well, the calculation, of course, is made up of, you've got various units, so you've got various capex, so ore sorters, transport to the plant, purchase costs, the capital, the solar energy plant for the ore sorter, all of those added together, they go to a capital cost. And so then, as you mine, you produce revenue and you incur cost. So more or less, in a very simplistic way of looking at it, take the cost from the revenue as a surplus, divide that into the capex, and you arrive somewhere near the figure I'm talking about in terms of number of months it takes to get your money back. And I used to have sort of direct links between payback and internal rate of return, but that's in the mid 30s to 40% internal rate of return, that sort of figure. So it's in terms of if you're a lender. And you're probably lending for 3 years, and of course, who says the deal is lending? It could well be equity as well. But let's say you look at it from the same point of view when you're a third party. If you're a lender, the terms are usually about 3 to 4 years, and we're actually saying the money back is in 18 months. And there was quite a bit of science. There's quite a bit of science in that. So we took the samples, the lending community were pretty keen that they be at this site where the first 3 years ore was coming from, to get them the comfort that they'd get the money back. So in actual fact, those holes were positioned in the first 3 years of mining in the open pits. So those figures apply, and the ore sample which was taken by drilling is in actual fact representative of the location of the first 3 years of mining. So that if you're a potential investor and you're distant from the project, when you actually know you had a hand in saying, well, let's see where the holes are being drilled and see how that performs in the ore sorting, these results are in actual fact should be replicating exactly what they can expect. And it's a pilot scale level, not the laboratory level. So if you're talking about getting comfort, and this really gave them comfort and gave us comfort, of course, and should give our shareholders comfort.
From a technical point of view, this all sort of test work that was done by Stoneup, it was on a sample representing these first 3 years of production. How did you ensure that the samples that you were using would cover 36 months into the future from when you start producing? Does that make sense?
Well, you've got a pit plan where you intend to
putting your ramp and start your open pit. So you actually know what you're looking at it in plan. So you draw a big circle round there, and then we draw the number of holes within that circle.
Well, you
Really
make it
scientific
sound.
as that.
It's amazing, isn't it? Sometimes it sounds very complex, and then based on an average of those holes, what you came back, the average effectively comes back with pops out those numbers.
Yeah, well, I mean, in this type of ore body, in every type of ore body, you have variograms and statistics. And so really, yeah, I guess you would have to drill a lot more holes to say that's the perfect variogram, that's the perfect representative sample. But I mean, we didn't go up, we didn't go 15 miles up the take, or sort of pit number two, pit number three. We went to the place where we intend digging year one, two, and three. And so from our point of view, that sample is about as well, I was going to say, that sample is about as representative of you get. But of course, you never can take enough samples. The more samples you take, the
That's
less the statistical bit, the
so
less
at
the
some point you've
statistical.
got to put a spade in the ground, don't you?
Well, I mean, if you actually carry that argument to fruition, you mine the ore body with a drill machine, So at least in this day and age, we have the benefit of we don't do little polygons and join them up and all of that. We've got what you call data mine, and they use this Cregan very
Modeling and
advanced
things, computer models, yeah.
geostats. And so they cut out the nugget effect. And so if you can get a reasonable variogram, they're quite happy that that population of holes will in actual fact be a fair representation of the average grade over the period of the mining. And that's exactly the methodology that we employed.
Colin, this is all based on the 190,000 tons of contained copper that has been effectively JORC reported at Hope and Gorup. How
That's
big
it, yeah,
could
this is
this
all in the
potentially
area
be?
50. Yeah, that's
How
right.
big
This
could
is
this
that.
potentially be? Because I mean, we drove through and it's a huge area.
I mean, this sample and this mine, if you like, both, put both together. No, in fact, ignore the samples and this mine, if the 15 million tons, is quite frankly a small fraction of the 17 kilometers of the mining license. It's a very small fraction, this first mine. And of course, we've had extensions which we've reported in the RNSs and things like that. But we've got two more extensions. So I think we're 52 kilometers from where the initial mine is to, in actual fact, where our license ends. You will recall, I guess, in podcasts, we say that the people who were there before assumed that anything above 150 meters would be oxides. So they started their drilling campaign to 150 meters and more. So we've got all that in all resources, 63,000 meters, I think it is. And then, of course, from 150 meters to surface, it was assumed that that would all be oxide. Well, it isn't. It's sulfides all the way to surface with a little oxide, of course. And so though we've got a perfect target for these mini pits. So the method of mining that we're going to employ is so sort of basic, it can't be true. It's like the little chrome mines out in South Africa. You're going to have a 70 or 80 meter eye wall. That amounts to a drill machine, a couple of trucks, and then an excavator. It really is not rocket science. It is digging. It's not even advanced civil engineering. It's basic digging. And down to 70 meters, you're not talking about slope stability being a major problem. You're not talking about, having sort of gradual slopes because you're going to go down to 1,000 meters. No, you can make, you everything working for you. And no, and the main thing here, of course, is no overburden. You're straight into it. You're actually standing on the ore body. So you're straight into it, straight into it.
It's
Very good.
sulfides at the surface are quite rare, really, aren't they? I mean, like wherever everyone goes drilling, you
Oh,
expect
listen.
the oxides, and then you're looking for the sulfides underneath to get a massive deposit, aren't you? Generally.
I've come into it, I've come to a situation generally in deserts, desert terrains. I've come across it in Chile, and I've come across it in obviously in Namibia, and it is rare. Normally, you expect a run of oxides, then transition zero, which is neither oxide nor sulfide, mixed, and then you get into the true sulfides. Sometimes, of course, that can be 30, 50 meters. And then, of course, to get into another problem is you need a two different types of plant. You need a sulfide plant and an oxide plant.
Yeah, that is a big problem for a
And
lot of
then, of
people.
course, you get into that complication. Although life, in this day and age, if you've got a minimal oxide cap, if you like, you can sulfidize it and make the oxide think it's a sulfide, make the plant recognize.
I'm not sure I trust those machines, to be honest.
Sulfurization. No, I don't. Well, I don't think I'd be writing home about it either. So, but it does work. It does work. But I think you can't count on recoveries.
I guess if you get into production and you're generating free cash flow and everything's going according to plan, where would you want to explore next? Where would you want to put the drill bit down first?
It's as obvious as the nose on your face is that we've got to do that and we've got to do it quick. So you'll be diverting some free cash flow, not a lot, into drilling. For the immediate production plan, we want to do as much open pit mining as we can. And we reckon at the moment we've got 6 to 9 years. We don't want to go underground as part of this plan. So the next plan would be, in actual fact, to close up the spacing of the plus 150, explore 150 to surface, build up a bigger resource as we can. And I'm talking about a tier one resource, but it's going to be a large copper resource hopefully in the 750,000 tons of contained copper plus. Because you are talking about 17 kilometers here. That's a long strike, and it's visible, it's in front of you. It's not as though you're searching for gold targets. It's not as though you've got to go out and know a lot of geophysics and a lot of geochemistry. There it is. It's all drilling targets. So you drill and you hit, you drill and you miss, and then you build up a model from there.
And I guess it gave its all surface as well. I mean, you're not drilling particularly deep either. So it should be relatively cheap.
In actual fact, it's the deep ore, quite a few areas where it's nicely drilled. So in fact, as I say, for plan A, to keep your pit going and to mini pits, and those holes are not going to be any deeper than down to 150. So they're all going to be shallow. But to actually extend the ore body, you've got to drill in the areas where the old guys didn't drill in 1970s, and you've got to improve the density of some of their drilling. And then to sustain this mining plan and make it last longer, you've got to do near surface drilling in order to maximize the amount of open pit mining you do, and to optimize the order and the quantity of which you take out of each.
Yeah.
Because what our work is allowing us to do, and this is why we did the optimization. The idea will be to have two or even three of these mini pits working, so that we can blend for high grade, the higher grade. And then, of course, it's only 64% capacity. Now we've got that Chalcosite site out. It's below that. So we can actually, by the guys in Germany, can set the machine, both the cameras and the X-rays, and they can set the machine to actually, if you want grade, you get grade. If you want recovery, you get recovery. So obviously, you can actually tailor this machine within a few hours that where you actually hit a very high, if hit a very high spike in the copper price, you could actually either go for maximum contribution by high grading, or you can actually say, right, well, low grade, because the price is very high. So it gives you tremendous flexibility in financial planning as well as technical planning when you're out there mining. It is really a sophisticated piece of equipment.
Sounds wonderful. I mean, that flexibility is going to help massively, especially with copper bouncing between 4 and 5. Nobody knows whether it's going to rocket higher or come down a little bit. This is obviously year to date, it's going very high. So just finally from me, on the 6th of February, we had an RNS on Mankayan, its project update, and the merger with Blackstone Minerals on the ASX. What's the plan behind this merger? And it seems to me now that your shareholding in Blackstone Minerals is going to be more than the market capitalization of Bazant as it stands. Is that correct at the moment?
Well, that's right. I think the share price as we stand is 56p. And I think, if you look at our convertible, we've got a
56 cents. Bag
of 50, yeah, so it's a 56 pence, so of course. Then we're actually, the value to us in terms of convertibles and, the old shareholding, I think it's about 4.4 million pounds. And then, of course, we had a capital raising. So the company's all cash. Bazant is not valued in our company. And, of course, we have that battery manganese in Botswana up the road. So when you think about it, there's no lockup on those shares. So would we want to sell them? And hopefully we won't want to sell them. But at the moment, the company is all cash, and it equals its market cap.
And I think that pretty much sells it for me. I mean, you can buy shares in Bazant right now. you get your value from Mekayan and you get the entire Open Guru for free. It's almost a way of putting it. I can say that. I know you can't. If we're talking,
That, 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 well, that's the way the numbers present themselves, isn't it? I mean, that's the way the numbers present themselves.
Yes.
There's
And numbers don't lie.
whatever the share pricing is, multiplied by the number of shares equals the strategic investment cash plus what we raised. Yeah, plus what if you add in what we raised, we're slightly in front in cash, I think.
Well, you've got the raise money as well, as you say. You have them in kind, shares on the ASX, and you have Bazans as well. It's all looking quite rosy from this share price point. And I guess, that's where I'd like to leave the interview because I think we're going to have more updates in the near future, aren't we? We can talk about more in
We
depth.
are indeed. We are indeed. Yeah, we're getting to that time now. Well, it's we're getting to that time now where the news flow. There's obviously the bulletin boards talk about how you're going to finance this project. The bulletin boards also talk about licenses and the environmental side of it, which of course is fixed and in place. And we, it's just as always, we're waiting for the piece of paper which says that the licenses is granted in total. So we're waiting for that piece of paper. I know the market is quite anxious to see that. If they're anxious, you can imagine how anxious I am, especially after those results. But we're reliably we our expectations are that that license will be issued, and we won't be waiting too long for it.
Good to hear.
It all forms. I think that there's I want to get rid of the misconception too. That license application, sorry, the environmental was all integral and part of the main license. So when they said intent to issue a license, it's not as though there was a separate action going on for the environmental permit. It was all contained, but it is a different unit of the mines department, and they do their work and they do it diligently. So we await their decision.
Okay, well, on that note, we'll say Colin Bird, Executive Chairman of Bezant Resources. Thanks very much for appearing on the podcast.
And thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure, as always. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Okay, let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers of this week. The best I've got this week in terms of, return to date was Symi, Supply At Me, Alessandro Zamboni. Do you remember those days, Kev? Do you remember Supply At Me?
I do indeed, yes.
Yeah, so that they provided an update on the funding position, particularly regarding its ongoing financing from the Avant-Garde Group, controlled by CEO Alessandro Zamboni. Despite previous funding commitments, the Avant-Garde Group has yet to fulfil a 2.04 million drawdown under a 3.5 million pound shareholder loan facility, while TAG has provided 2.8 million pounds to Symi across 2023 and 24. Payments have been delayed, and late payment interest of 277,000 remains outstanding. So I think there's some sort of undergoing debt restructuring, but that's moved about 70% this week. Emerson, another one, they're up some
Have they
50.
moved to 100 billion shares yet, or
I can't remember what the actual shares outstanding is. Let's have a quick look. Supply At Me is running 71 billion.
okay, they're getting there.
Getting there. I thought there was a limit in terms of the number you can have, but obviously, clearly not on the market in terms of actual share. I thought you had to do a consolidation at some point,
No. There's no infinite. We have infinite share.
infinite.
I've thought this before, Phil, before you continue. Could you create an AIM company, right? With the express purpose of trying to dilute with the maximum amount of shares? Could you get to a multi-billion pound market cap just because shares must have some kind of value? Just keep putting them out there just
Yeah,
for
1
everyone else to
trillion
get them.
shares valued at
100 trillion
0.0.
shares worth of, a tenth of a penny.
Yeah, proper
Yeah.
confetti machine, that one. What about Emerson? Emerson is up 50%. Charles, give us an update on Emerson. I don't really know much. I know they've got this big, is it the Chemisette project in Morocco? And I really like the asset, but it just feels like it's one of those that never kind of gets the funding off the ground. Do you know much about Emerson?
Oh yeah, Emerson was my moonshot for 2025, so I'm very happy with that. I bought in at the end of 2024, so what are we up now? It's kind of like, is it trebled yet? I'm hoping so. No, only doubled, sadly. But basically, there's litigation funding that's been secured to go after Morocco effectively for a lot of money, and basically, it looks like they're probably going to win that litigation, and people are starting to realize that, so everyone's just piling in. So it's more of litigation, like a legal thing, rather than about the asset, in the same way as Greenex Metals. And there's another one as well, isn't there? I can't remember the other one off the top of my head. Litigation company. Do you remember?
Yeah, the Zenith Energy, which
Zenith,
they've had a good week again. I mean, they're sort of bouncing around the 8-9p mark, but it'd be interesting to see whether they get any
But
news
Zenith's a
on.
very interesting one because if they win this case, the settlement is $620 million, and they currently, I think, have a market cap of about 20 million, do they? Maybe it's a little higher than that. But so, I mean, we discussed this. I mean, if you want to bet on this, and I think it's coming out in the next couple of weeks, 22nd of February, I think, is the D-Day. Is that Zenith? If they win, and let's say they only get half the money, or even less than half the money, $300 million, converted into sterling is going to be what? 240 million pounds,
Yeah, they've got a
230
current
million
market cap
pounds.
at 8p. They've got a market cap of 36 million, so it's circa £40 million money.
Okay, so 36 to 40 million, and they could be looking at 240 million if they get half the money after costs and everything else. So big 6-to-1 ratio, really,
It's
in
got to be. I mean,
terms of
obviously the
gain.
risks are there if it doesn't come through, but they did a private placement as well recently, didn't they? Which was well received. The other ones that in terms of the RNS, standout RNSs of the week, obviously we saw Power Metal Resources agreed in principle to sell circa 29 million shares and warrants in Guardian Metal Resources, GMET, to UCAM for £9.23 million, subject to fundraising and finalizing a sale and purchase agreement within 10 business days. If completed, Power Metal will retain a 19.2% stake in GMET, with proceeds used to redeem a £2 million loan note and for corporate purposes. Sean Wade highlighted the 966% return on investment as a validation of the company's incubator model and reaffirmed commitments to GMET's future. So almost a 10-bagger there, Sean, on that one. What do we make of that? I mean, a lot of people said, "Oh, you could have held a bit longer or something," from what I believe on the boards. But what I think that was a pretty astute investment.
Yeah, I think it was absolutely cracking deal. I mean, yes, you could have waited longer, but somebody wants to buy it, so sell it, and you're still holding nearly 20% of GMET for upside. The more important thing is, does he believe he has more 10 baggers to use the 9 million quid to put into? And I think he does. There was also news on Friday, I think, about the uranium that they struck something very, very nice, I think,
Effective, yeah.
on Friday. And he's definitely moving. Everybody knows because it's in the market about FDR, Australian-based company. It's going to be a bit like GMET. It's going to list out. You've got stuff happening in Saudi Arabia as well. So you could be looking at Power Metal having a minimum of three type GMET scenarios within the next few months. So is it worth more than it is, Charles?
100%. Like I think it could re-rate fairly quickly, regardless of what the volume's looking like now. I mean, if you look at that deal, I mean they bought the assets for Guardian Power Metal, but Paul Johnson, the former CEO of Power, I think they bought the original Guardian Metal assets for the £1-2 million,
Yeah, they
and
bought them
then
from Thor, didn't they? I bet you Thor had them.
back in the day. Obviously, this was before the tungsten market went crazy, but they foresaw potentially what was going to happen, and then you've got 7 million out of it, and you're still retaining effectively a 20% shareholding. You have no cash concerns. You've got what's going on with Saudi Arabia as well. But more importantly, the Guardian Metal, it actually creates a real valuation for the company, because previously the share price was based on a small effective free float because Power had so many of the shares. But having now sold them, you've now had an institution validate the value of that company. And therefore, and the other thing is when people talk, "Oh, he could have held on to them and sold them for more." No, possibly not. Possibly the buyer, Bacon, or UCAM, the company behind it, they want some upside when they're buying as well. So the time of the deal is, it's got to be good for both parties. Power's got a massive amount of cash in the bank. Guardian's had its valuation updated, and UCAM are now incentivized to make sure Guardian succeed as well. So it's a win-win-win. Fantastic.
Now,
Very
so
nice
why do
one.
we think that the share price on Power has not really done, 15p, circa 17 million cap, £9 million potentially? Obviously, that's got to be all approved and it's not done deal yet, but it looks good. 150 million shares outstanding, not many. It's obviously done the consolidation from the was 100 to 1 or whatever it was. why do we feel like power metals have, the valuation has not been realized? When you look at the valuation and it still holds that a large percentage share, I mean, surely the valuation of the cash and the GMET shares now is almost the cap, and it's almost putting
And you've
no
also got the 10 million uranium joint venture and then the Saudi stuff as well. I mean, it's had this undervaluation thing has been going on for at least the past 2 years. Shareholders, the shareholders that are in Power Metal are not selling. It's just new shareholders coming in. And the question is why? And I would argue potentially that it's because Sean is doing everything properly, which sounds counterintuitive, right? But when he inherited the portfolio, it was kind of a disparate thread of, dozens of projects. And then he's either sold or done deals on all of them. And then he's done a uranium deal. And now he's sold the GMET. And now he's working in Saudi Arabia. And this all takes time. And investors are very impatient,
Yeah, and I
But
think he gets a quite a lot of people berating him. Maybe that is I do feel when I talk to him, he's quite frustrated with the situation there. Not necessarily his performance, because as you say, he's delivering it. But he
done
feels
everything,
like, so
yeah.
there's a lot of critics out there who are giving him a lot of stick, and I always feel he's quite frustrated and stressed about the whole thing.
Well, I think it's, I'd agree with that. I mean, we did a pod, I remember when it was a few months ago, he kind of, he wasn't particularly happy with the
No.
market or the investors. And he was like, to the brokers, I'm not putting words in Sean's mouth, but the message was effectively, fuck off, I'll get my money from elsewhere, which he now has. Well done to him. But, I think one of like the key issues with it is that when you look at junior resource, right, all of the most popular companies have one flagship asset because it's very simple to understand. So whether that's Sovereign with Cassiar or Greatland Gold with Javier on, or a Guardian with, I know they've got Tempe now, but Pilot Mountain's always been the story, and so on and so forth. Power is so many assets that it's a harder market. It's a harder company to market, isn't it? It just is.
It is, but I think that the market is two things, has been two things. I think it's going to start changing, but has been two things. You either want to invest in something that's going to go up like 1,000 times, and that's what everybody's looking at. Okay. Or you go to the other end where you want a dividend play and somebody's giving you a dividend. The thing in the middle that's actually got the potential to do 100, 200%. Not exciting enough for a lot of people, but I think people need to start changing their mindsets and saying, well, actually, that is pretty exciting. I mean, we just heard about Byzantine in terms of Colin. Why is the assets that they're going to hold in this company in Australia worth more than the market Byzantine?
Nobody knows. I mean,
Sense.
there's been times throughout the past year where a metal shareholding in Guardian Metals was worth more than Power Metals market capitalization.
Yeah,
And the
it's
same
the
with
same.
Teck Capital and Microsalt. I'm not sure if you guys know that company, but Teck Capital is the parent of Microsalt, owns most of the shares. Microsalt often has a higher market cap than Teck Capital. It's just utterly bizarre.
Is Tech Capital the one that has Gen IP as well now?
Well, exactly. And Gen IP is an interesting story because I covered their IPO back in the day, and then they did the IPO, the stock sunk afterwards, and then it rocketed back up, and it's absolutely fine now. So, if there are
Okay,
any
well,
other
let's
AI companies out there.
the whole if we go into the whole world of copper, you've got a situation now where we're pretty sure there's going to be a deficit of copper going forward. We've got companies now that are worth less than assets that they hold, that hold big copper assets. We're talking about Byzant. I'd suggest that Eastern Resources is also one of those. You've got Extract Resources, which is also one of those. You've got Galileo, which is also one of those. Who else are we talking about? You've got Guardian Metal now, who also have, the potential for Garfield, big copper resources. You've got so many companies now that really intrinsically, in terms of their asset valuations, are significantly higher than the value that is being placed on them. Now,
That
what's got to
really,
change for that to
yeah.
change? It doesn't make sense. Because if they're in another market, if they're in Australia, I mean, as we saw with the Byzant deal that was done, the Australian market really liked it, and it went up from sort of low 20 cents to 2.6 or 60 cents or whatever the the stipulation was just within a few days. So wow,
Yeah,
why?
it looked good. It
Well,
looked good.
it's the Australia thing is really simple, right? I mean, I'm not sure if you guys noticed, but they just I'm gonna find it quickly, hang on. They've just released, billions and billions of dollars, for effectively in grant funding and, low interest loans for critical minerals for tax incentives law. So huge production tax breaks for critical minerals. But like even before that, things like personal tax taxation, like franking credits, which we got rid of in 2016, or the fact that corporate expenses, if you want to issue shares as a service, for example, this is a key quote from London Stock Exchange. You're a public company on the main market of the LSE and you want to issue 50 grand in shares as payment for services, you're going to have to pay a minimum of 16,000 plus VAT as a fee. If you do the same on the ASX, it'll cost you the equivalent of £800.
It's mental, isn't it?
It's mental. When you really think about it, you have refundable tax offsets as well for research and development. And you have the exploration development incentive, right? So if you're an investor and an explorer, you can pretty much claim back, the vast majority of the losses the company makes on exploration. And then things like, if there's a placing, the company will get suspended for a few days while they conduct the placing, so the share price can't be sold down. There's so many things Australia does differently and better that we could easily copy and we just choose not to. And then you
Yeah,
wonder
we
why.
wouldn't have all this shorting when effectively people, when it is announced that to the investment community, it's announced that there's going to be a placing.
Yeah, 100%.
And then people sell it down
Well, this is the
because they've
thing. I
got no
mean,
scruples, even though it says, this is illegal, you are legally inside, etc. It's just a whisper
the thing
here
is,
and a
only takes
whisper
one
there.
person to break the rule, and nobody, like, I've never done it. But the thing is, everyone knows, I say everyone, the 100 or so people who take part in the placings in the junior resource sector in London, they know a few days before, generally. And it only takes one person to decide to short, and then that's it. It's worse as what should happen is the stock gets suspended, and then the placing is announced to investors.
Which
It's
is
as
what they do
simple
in
as
the
that.
on the ASX,
Yeah,
right? It's
that's
generally,
exactly what they do.
exactly what they do.
I
Right,
think.
guys, there's a couple I want to talk about. Let's get these in. Conroy Gold and Natural Resources, they had an update in the week on the Discs of Gold project in Ireland. They'd done the relogging program for Clontibret drill core. That's well advanced, contributing to a robust 3D geological model and supporting discussions with strategic and financial partners for the next investment cycle. The company aims to secure re EU recognition of Clontibret as a strategic minerals project under the European Critical Raw Materials Act, giving it antimony potential. So, what do we make of that? Obviously, they've done this relogging of 16,000 plus meters of core, including the PXRF analysis, enhancing the structural understanding and helping to really identify those high grade zones at depth. And they've also done additional work at Clay Lake and on the Skulmartin Gold Trend as well, with promising geochemical anomalies. Now, Charles, I know you caught up with Mariam when we were at the Resourcing Tomorrow, and obviously we had a good chat with her. But what do you make of those sort of the way that they're advancing and getting ready for this? I guess they're doing the relogging, but they also want to secure the recognition and also discussions with the strategic final fi financial partners to really get a partner involved in the whole project.
Well, I think what they're doing is with Marion, she's decided to explore it like a major with limited funding that they have, which is a different approach to what's been done historically, where for lack, they've gone down a drilling campaign with DEMIRE, but it's not been particularly targeted well, and that's what you've seen in the results that have come out of the ground. As the thing is, that is the only way to do. The only way you're going to attract another JV partner is to do that, relogging, reanalysis, a little bit of surface exploration. To tempt them in almost like a little fish on a fishing pole. And then regarding the application for the European Critical Raw Materials Act and to be Clontibret to be recognized as a strategic project, whenever a small cap at this level of market capitalization has done this successfully, there's always been a very big jump in the share price. GreenRoc is a good example, actually. When they submitted their he just submitted their application, I mean the share price doubled on the day, didn't it? So that's something to keep an eye on as well. And the other thing with Conroy, even though it has been sold off so massively, is it is a stock ticker, a stock name that everybody knows. I think we could probably all agree on that. Like it is one that sort of everyone's heard of. So if it does get motoring, hopefully if it does re-rate to, a bit more of a fairer level, then it should move fairly quickly. But it is one of those stocks where we're now sort of investors are kind of waiting for, news of a potential new joint venture, however long that takes.
I mean, the SP has been absolutely decimated, isn't it? I mean, what was it trading around the 2-3 pence mark from memory? I mean, I've not
Well,
really looked lately.
this is the question I pose, right? In today's climate, $2,900 gold, okay, with 512,000 ounces of JORC gold, owning the Clontribute asset, antimony probably of at least the same quantum and possibly significantly more. How much is Clontribute as a standalone asset, which is basically what they're looking at now? How much is it worth? In real terms, how much is it worth?
What's it worth? Like, how much do you
Market
sell
values
it
it at
for?
zero, effectively, or not
Well,
much zero, but unfortunately, until they get it out the ground, it's not got any value, has it, really?
if what you can sell it for is the question, that's the issue. The number of ounces of gold in the ground times the gold price is one price. What you can get someone to pay for it is another. I
Cost to
mean,
get it out, all-in
but
sustaining costs,
let's
etc.
say that the value of it today is $100 an ounce of JORC, and I don't think that's over the top. Then you're talking about
50 million plus the autonomy.
Well, I mean, another way of putting it is that Cormoray's got a market cap of about 1.3 million. There's about
Exactly.
300 grand in cash in the company, maybe roughly. There's generally a few hundred thousand, and then a shell of any company, any smaller company, is worth around 1 million nowadays. As in, if you just want to buy a shell off a company, So the gold in the ground is being valued at nothing, being all of the assets. So you do get a very good deal if you buy down here, but it's a case of how long will it take for it to come back up, and that's all. I will say, speaking to Marion at Minds of Money in December, she was very confident that she could do something different, that she could generate a actual real return, but also that it's not something that could be rushed, and it had to be done properly.
Yeah.
But we shall see.
I've seen them operate extremely differently in the last 3 to 6 months since the
Yes,
passing of Professor
it's a reset.
Conroy.
They've reset.
It's a reset. They're now saying we're going to prepare all these projects
And
and
go to PDAC.
we know what we want. You heard earlier with we spoke with them about Carillion Diamonds, and we'll put an excerpt in as well about that so that you can listen to what they had to say. But they have a very specific idea. They want $4 million for the colored diamond project, and Clontribret now is going to be the same situation. But the interesting thing from all the drilling and all this logging that really piqued my interest was that they seem to believe now that Clontribret, Clay Lake are connected, maybe only with stockwork, but ultimately are connected. Now, those two things are 7 kilometers apart, and that basically means that there could potentially be 7 kilometers of what they believe now is Fosterville-like gold, where within the first 200 meters you're getting low gold grades, but not that low. They're still talking about 1.7 to 2 grams per ton. But the deeper you go, the higher the grades potentially will be. Now, that obviously all has to be proved. But if that has to prove, this is far bigger, far, far bigger than Greatland Gold and that we have in Australia. It's huge.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just the last my last thought on that one before we move on, Bill. What you really want is you want the management team at Cormoray Gold to be able to go to conferences and say, right, we've picked out 10 drill locations. These are exactly where we want to put the drill in. This is the money we need. This is why you should fund us to do it. I don't, and I guess that's a question to ask Marion, or the next time you guys speak to Cormoray, how far are we from that? And then that's where you'll probably get the buyers come back.
We talked to Carillion in the week, and as you say, that they are based on the fact that they provided an update on the licensing and operations. Obviously, they've got Kumo in Finland, where they've got this elusive search for the green
The
diamond,
green diamonds.
Limpira, and then they've got the Saitapira kimberlite permit extended for 3 years, reinforcing the area's potential. So that one looks really good. In Lakjoki, the landowner compensation is expected to be finalized in the first half of 2025. But yeah, we caught up with the geologist, Kevin McNulty, senior geologist there, and have a listen to what he had to say. We saw some recent news where the company provided an update on its licensing and operations. In Kumo, Finland, the company has extended exploration licenses, including the new Kumu-1 reservation at Lentira, and plans further drilling on its green diamond discovery. The Saitapira kimberlite permit has been extended for 3 years, reinforcing the area's potential as a major diamond province. in Latjoki, Finland, landowner compensation is expected to be finalised in H1 2025, a key step towards mine development with strategic partners being sought. So, Kevin, I mean, if you could just talk us through this news, and obviously one thing I want to focus on is this talk of obviously diamonds and particularly the rare green diamond in the Kuhmo region of Finland. You know, in the past, we've seen the announcement of the discovery of the green diamond. I think it was back in January 27, and this diamond was described as a clear pale green dodecahedron, obviously a very rare find. So just talk us through the latest news and then give us a bit of background onto the search for this elusive rare green diamond, please.
Yeah, we as I say, we found the diamond in Till. We were following up a regional Till program that had discovered indicator minerals. And then we did some more sampling in the area. We discovered this green diamond in Till. As you know, a diamond is the best indicator mineral for a diamondiferous source that you can find. And obviously, being a colored diamond, a green diamond particularly, they're extremely rare. So knowing that the source could contain these rare green diamonds, yeah, makes it even more exciting, because the value added by those colored stones is very significant in the diamond market. The other thing that we've been doing is we've been following that up systematically. And then we have just tried, we did some airborne magnetics with the drone, and we identified a whole series of targets. And then just recently, we released it in January, I think it was, the 24th of January, the EM drone survey that we've done. Now, this is a real new, innovative technique. I don't know if anyone else has been doing it, but certainly we are the first in Finland, if not the first, one of the first in the world doing this type of technique. And it has picked out a stonker of an anomaly. And I say, it makes me so excited about this. It's just amazing. We actually have
is that a technical term, Kevin? Stonker?
Yeah.
So you're pretty convinced nobody dropped a green diamond out their pocket now?
No, I'm very convinced that no one's dropped a green diamond, because, as I say, we have all these indicator minerals as well, including G9s, G10s, and I don't get into all the technical bits about that. But as I say, this anomaly is right up ice from it, and it is significant. And we can actually model this through the geophysics to depth, and it shows a similar type of carrot shape that you have for a kimberlite, which, again, is fantastic, and we get very excited about this. I know I wave my hands around because I'm actually so excited about it. But as you know, kimberlites are a conveyor. Diamonds form at depth, and basically a kimberlite takes those diamonds at depth and brings them up to surface through these sort of carrot-shaped tubes. And when we model this geophysics anomaly, it forms one of these carrot-shaped tubes. So that, in conjunction with the indicators down ice from it, the green diamond down ice from it, makes me super, super excited. So as our friend Mr. Trump would say, drill, baby, drill. This is really a significant target.
I want to bring you both to the other part of Carillion Diamonds, because, I mean, Carillion until a couple of years ago was what we've just talked about, which was Finland. But now all of this discovery in Northern Ireland in terms of what's in Fermanagh and what's in Antrim, you know, tell us a bit about that, Kevin, and then I'll come on to Kat.
Sure, yeah, we have... Obviously, we started out an exploration program there, which we were looking at, but we discovered these significant indicator minerals that show possibly the presence of copper, nickel, PG, platinum group elements present there. So it was pretty exciting. We started to do some more work and take out some ground. We got an international expert, a guy called Dr. Larry Hulbert, to look at it for us, and he was amazed at what we had in this area. And as I say, we've put quite a few slides up in the information there, but we have basically identified a whole series of targets within these areas, including in the Coalbrook area. We've identified 45 targets for further follow-up work, which we have been doing. We've been looking, doing some grassroots work on these, and we'll be doing some geochemical sampling on these. And it's basically to whittle those down to drilling targets. And similarly, in the Antrim area, we have some identified a whole significant series of targets there. But it's quite exciting. It's a whole new area that hasn't really been explored before, and we're getting some fantastic results. And there's already been platinum nugget found up in Lar, up near Antrim there, which is quite significant. But there's also been bedrock platinum found in the area as well, associated down in Carlingford, associated with the dikes in the area. And that's really our target, is these dikes that are running along out from the basically if you've seen Iceland, you know, these rifting sort of opening and you get these big lava flows and whatever else. Well, that's exactly what dikes are. So they bring up the mineralization system, a bit like what's happening in Iceland now. But this was 60 million years ago when the Atlantic Ocean started to rift a midget in the beginning, formed all these dikes. So that's basically the mineralization we're chasing. But it would be very similar to, if you're familiar with the Eagle Mine in America, in Michigan, it would be, that's pretty much our target. So it's a very small footprint, but very rich in copper, nickel type of mineralization stuff.
And this gentleman that you mentioned has been involved with the Eagle Mine in America or not?
He's been involved with a whole series of things. I think he has been involved with Eagle, but he's certainly, he's considered one of the leading experts in the world in it. So it's pretty excellent to have him on board and working with us and identifying, helping us to identify. Mm-hmm. And as I say, he's pretty excited about these targets that we have. So
good.
As I say, so and the chemistry is right. Everything is right. So we're moving it forward.
So what do you make? I mean, I've never really taken your thoughts, Charles, on Carelian and this, you know, this elusive, obviously there's big premiums paid for not only the green diamonds and the pink diamonds, but what do you make of Carelian?
Obviously, again, it's one of these companies that we, at the bottom end of the market, right? But the green diamond and the search for it looks very exciting. So for example, let's talk for it. We've already got the preliminary economic assessment for Lotoki, right? Okay, it doesn't consider the potential for the colored diamonds, but highlights from the PEA, 2.11 million carats recoverable, okay, a 9-year mine life with payback in year two, internal rate of return of 55%, a net present value of $39 million. Okay, so straight away you have something that has value. Obviously, at the moment, the diamond market is kind of in the dumps, so that PEA may be out of date already. The basic point you need to understand is it's very hard to attract investment for diamonds at the moment. And you can see it in the market that the artificial diamonds have pretty much destroyed the market. Where you can get real value is in green diamonds. So the green diamond that Carelian discovered within Kumo, 0.8 millimeter diameter, you're not going to get artificials of these. And these are incredibly desirable still, these colored diamonds. And so it's a bit unfair almost because they've discovered these diamonds, they've put out the PEA. They have value, but at the moment the diamond market is in the dumps. So in order to get investment, they've got to find the source of the green diamonds. And it's almost like a child's fairy, you know, like a child's story, isn't it? Like you've got to hunt down the green diamonds. And if they do find the green diamonds, then the demand will be massive and they'll be able to sign a deal, we'll sell it off or make loads of money or whatever. And then the question is, how long is it going to take them to find the green diamonds? Is it a one-off magical green diamond? No, that's not how these things work. They're definitely in the area. But how long?
Well, they said the source for green diamonds is green diamonds. You know, that's
exactly. It's there. It's going to be there. So, I mean, basically, they've got to hunt them. They've got to hunt them. And shareholders, you know, if you're a shareholder and you're down here at sort of 1.5 million, you just have to be patient and hope that they find them. And yeah, that's it. That's pretty much it. You know, it's a hunt.
Well, as you alluded to earlier on, you know, you said just before we ran the piece there that they need to go to some sort of show and sort of, you know, seek a partner. And I think that's the plan is from when we spoke to Kevin is that they are really focusing on the PDAC, the PDAC show, which is it starts in March. It's only a couple of weeks away.
Yeah.
And let's hope that they can get this funding, this $4 million as they've planned for really and also maybe...
That's exactly what you need, though, don't you? Like, because often, I mean, I go to these conferences all the time. I'm sure you guys do as well. And you talk to companies, and they've got kind of a generic kind of this is what we're doing, this is kind of what we want to do, this is kind of what, and it's not what you want to hear. Especially if you're trying to attract investment, what you want to hear is this is the work we've done so far, this is the evidence we have, this is what we need to do next, and this is the money we need to fund it. And so when Kevin goes, we need $4 million to do this work in this location, that's what you want to hear. You know, now, will he get it? I don't know. But that's a hell of a lot of a better plan than, you know, anything else that we've had so far.
Okay. What about Aterian? They had some news at the beginning of the week of the restart of the Rwanda mineral trading operations. Now, Kevin, I know you caught up with Charles and Simon down
there. Yeah, of course, with Charles.
Any thoughts on that?
He basically, there was problems obviously in Rwanda and they had to stop and sort it out. Now it's all going to be certified, I think, through the government channels. And I think the potential for it to be a much bigger operation is now there. So, yeah, I'm expecting that to work quite well now. I mean, we've seen it ourselves. And Tyrion and Charles and Simon should be on the show in the next week or two. As I say, I met them in Ndaba. Yeah, especially when Liverpool beat Spurs 4-0. I was watching it with Charles as a Spurs supporter, so he wasn't very... he was very amicable, actually, but yeah. So they were staying on, or he was staying on for some other stuff. So this week wasn't going to work, but certainly next week I think we will try and grab them. It's interesting what's happening with Rio Tinto. They had good meetings while they were in Ndaba with Rio. And yeah, let's see what happens and what results come from HCK1.
Well, they had two holes, didn't they, which should be coming back very soon. And then against Saving Kigali. So, but they also restarted the drilling in the new year. So yes, you have these two holes back, but then you should have more assays coming back, a steady flow as well.
Okay, so another good mover this week, which we saw sort of move up to the early nines, was Greatland Gold. Seemed to be a lot of volume on that one. Any thoughts on it, Charles?
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, you had Sean and Symphony out some superlative interviews, which is obviously helping. And then just in terms of, you know, the fundamental disconnect between the price of gold, their all the sustaining cost, what's going on with Telfer and Havieron, it makes a lot of sense for it to be, you know, moving back up, moving upwards to a fair evaluation. However, my perspective on this, and I could be wrong, this is something that you guys can double check for yourselves. And this wasn't something that I uncovered. I had plenty of emails and messages coming to me. The VanEck Small Cap Gold Miners ETF, GDXJ, appears to hold significantly less Greatland Gold shares than it ought to based on the index it tracks. So the US version holds roughly $20 million of its total holdings, 0.41%. But on the UK side, Greatland Gold represents 0.8% of its holdings. So you're expecting $20 million or so of Greatland Gold will need to be bought by GDXJ at some point in the near future in order to continue tracking its index, or it's going to get in a bit of trouble with the authorities. And the funny thing is, people are buying shares because they're expecting these shares to be bought by this fund, which is pushing up the price of it, and they didn't want to pay the Greatland Gold share price when it was lower, and it's creating the potential for a short squeeze. This is the theory. Obviously, when it comes to the reality, things don't always work out that way, but it's going to be very volatile and it's going to be very fun, and that's where we are.
So do you think you can see it going into double figures on this basis over the next sort of three,
it could,
four,
it could,
five
I don't
weeks?
Want to be too rampy, right? Because you don't want to drag people in. And like I say, it's going to be very volatile, but it is possible. Because while Greatland does have a plus £1 billion market cap, its volume, you know, on a daily basis is not actually that high. So if you add in a significant amount of buying, it'll turn the tables and it'll push things up. So yeah, I think it's doable.
Good. I think we're 6 weeks into the year, and in our part of the world, as in our part of the market, things are moving. Things are starting to move. So and it's from very low levels ultimately, isn't it? So, you know, we've got all of these different things that we've talked about today, whether it be gold, whether it be copper, whether it be silver. You know, I think there's a lot of movement in the equity side of things to move up. So, yeah, let's watch this space. There's one last thing I want to talk about, which is what's been happening on Friday with one of the stocks that we have covered in the past. It's Encantera, and it seems like a bit leaky. Something's happening in the background, because now people are starting to think, oh, maybe this is coming back. Basically, there was some legal action against the compounds or whatever it was that it had for its products. But the interesting thing is there's two companies interlinked here. You've got Immunopharma and Encantera, who effectively have the same CEO, chairman. And they have a warrant that is coming to be paid, or an option, I think it is. I think it's at 9.5p. And they now have the cash to buy that option, which could mean that Encantera have plenty of cash if they use that option. So that's one to look out for. I think on Friday when we were recording this, It was doing very well. It was up
Trading around
21%.
about 11 to 11.5 pence on
Yeah.
Friday. So it moved, I mean, it has moved up about 50% of the week, so it's one of the best movers.
And if you do you remember when that news was set out and you could buy under 3p?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I
That was
do.
a good deal.
It was
Did
a
you
good
buy
deal.
some?
I might have. I just told you, we had this conversation about this legal challenge, and my opinion then, and it hasn't changed. And again, caveat, we have to cross our fingers because when a legal challenge comes, you can't always know how it's going to pan out. But the timing of it was incredibly opportunistic. It was designed to cause maximum damage, right? It's a shakedown, is what it feels like. We don't know that.
Good point.
The potential upside was there. The fundamental business case hadn't changed. Once this legal action out of the way, assuming it is, everything will go back to hunky-dory and the share price will be fine again.
And the
Fingers
share price
crossed.
should be into the 30s in a matter of
Yeah,
days.
and
So
then away we go.
if you're in, if you're thinking, oh, this could be a nice three bagger, because it was 35p, I think, only a number of months ago, and before this all happened, it could be back there in a flash, literally.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to just talk to you about one other thing before we wrap up, that you wrote a very interesting article, Charles, in the week about gold, where you effectively, from what the take home I got was that obviously gold prices are soaring as central banks stockpile, COMEX struggles to meet the physical demand, and speculation grows over a potential return to the gold standard. Now, obviously, we also saw Ed Conway run a really interesting piece on Sky News with a slightly different take on the gold price rises, and he put it down to movement from the movement of gold from London to New York after the election spiked the price due to concerns over Trump's tariffs on precious metals. So a massive amount has been leaving London, or we're told, destined for New York City, New York's gold stores. So what first of all, what made you write that article? Because I think it's something very different from what the sort of piece you put out, right?
I just the thing is, right, the basic point beyond anything else that nobody can argue with is that historically, I'm talking up to about sort of 5 or 6 years ago, gold was and the US dollar worked as an inflationary hedge pair. So if US dollar got stronger, for example, interest rate rises or tariffs, gold gets weaker because it doesn't yield anything. And vice versa, when the US dollar gets weaker because they print loads of it or they have lower interest rates, gold gets stronger. But what we've seen is the US dollar gets stronger and stronger and stronger, and gold go to higher and higher record highs. So the model is broken. It's as simple as that. So what you're looking for is you're looking for reasons why, because from an investment perspective, I own gold, physical gold, but I have shares in Greatland Gold, as I'm sure you guys do, also in Amaroq Minerals and a couple of other gold producers. And the difference, a lot of these companies, if you've got an all-in sustaining cost of say $1,500 or $1,400 and a gold price of 3,000 and that 3,000 stays sustainable, the profits are immense. If the gold price comes back down or shoots higher, you have a completely changed investment case. And the big thing for me, it's the COMEX market in New York, right? So briefly, COMEX is a segment of the CME, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange Group, and it's the center of commodities trading in the world. It offers gold futures contracts. And the basic point is that the gold futures contracts, when generally you close a contract without actually taking control of the physical gold, because you're just speculating on the price. But over the past few months, and yes, you could argue it's about tariffs, but over the past few months, we're now getting closing in February 2025, COMEX delivery, so actual physical demand for actual gold, it's now reached over 60,000 contracts. It could reach a record 70,000. So tons and tons and tons of physical gold has been taken command of. And COMEX, has record stockpiles because it's sucking up all the gold from the rest of the world and then delivering it to customers. I speculate that potentially the US is going back to a gold standard and it's dragging all of its gold home to make that happen, which sounds, very tinfoil hat. I understand that. But at the same time, you look at this, rising, rising, rising gold price. You look at all of the gold, being sucked in. The fact you have so much gold demand that London literally cannot get the gold out of its vaults fast enough. It just seems to me that we're having a system that is potentially on the verge of breaking. Now, what I find quite exciting, if gold does shoot off to a record high, silver will shoot off to another record high as well.
Well, that's it. That's what I was going to come on to
Yeah,
next.
yeah.
Like, Ev says peace, but I wanted to ask you, because you said to me in the week, at what point do you sell your gold and start buying silver? Well, because Ev said earlier, the ratio is absolutely like, it's like 90 to well, 1.
It's crazy, isn't it? I mean, historically, they've always tracked each other, right? Very, very closely. And now gold is much higher than it should be compared to silver, or silver is much lower than the high should be compared to gold.
You know what the long-term historical average is over centuries for the ratio?
Go on, tell me, it's like 8 to 1 or something.
15 to 16 to 1. 15 or 16 to 1. In the 20th century, the average has been 40 or 50 to 1. And the recent trends we've seen exceeding 60, it reached 125 to 1 in April 2020 during obviously the COVID and the market turmoil. But I mean, it is, if it continued, what should it be if gold is 2900? You know, you're looking at around, if you look at the historical average of 16 to 1, silver should be around $181 per ounce.
What, 40 at the moment?
Yeah, exactly.
It's 34 and it's moving up because we've had silver move by over 4% just today. So there was a lot of talk in the market that if silver broke 33 and stayed above it, that it's really going to rally. It's going to close this gap. I think $60 to $70 silver is very plausible in 2025.
Oh yeah, I agree.
Right? I don't think that's out the question. And I think if you pull up a long term graph for silver, right? This has happened in 1974 and it happened in 2008, basically after the financial crisis. Okay. Now, is the situation any different? Are we coming into a financial crisis? In my view, it's no different. We are, right? The world is greatly in debt. Everything has to be devalued so that debt can be got rid of. And we're in a situation. Now, from the bottom of each one of those peaks in silver, silver did six times its bottom. So if you class that the bottom was around $14 to $15, six times that is between $80 and $90 where we think the peak will be. And maybe that isn't actually going to be the new peak. Maybe it's even higher than that because we don't know where gold is and we've never been in this situation before. But everything is setting up that silver is going to explode, and silver normally does explode as well. It doesn't just gradually, it pops, is right. And maybe it's not like it's going to pop over a day, but it's going to pop over a 6 month to 9 month period where we'll see, you know, gold's done 40%. Silver normally does 2 to 3 times whatever gold does. So can we see 120% move in silver? You know, say from 30, I think we can, which would take us to
silver. Actually, has 70. Uses when you look at silver for like solar panels and actual for antiseptic use and all sorts of you know basically as a greatest conductor of electricity. But the mad thing is silver. Like when you look at why is the chemical symbol Ag? Does anyone know what it means?
Latin, is it?
Yeah, so, well, it's Latin for argent or French, the French word argent, which is basically money because it is the oldest currency that we've known. Mm. So it actually has an actual currency value.
Yeah. I mean, the difference is obvious. Well, maybe not. It is the reason the gold price is rising so high is for COMEX, but it's for central banks buying from COMEX. So 2022, a record 1,082 tons of gold bought by central banks. 2023, 1,037 tons of gold, second highest annual after 2022. And then 2024, another 1,045 tons of gold. So you're seeing multiple years in a row of record gold buying by central banks.
Yeah.
Why are central banks buying gold at record pace? It has no utilitarian value because we don't have a gold standard. So why are they all doing it? China, Russia, the US. There's got to be a reason, a bigger reason. There's no country, I mean, obviously China and Russia is gold producing, sure, but no country massively benefits from high gold prices because it's quite a niche market.
Yeah.
So it must be that there's a wider plan. I think the gold standard is coming back. As crazy as it sounds, I think that's the answer.
Someone was saying on a podcast we were listening to that every 70 years there's a reset of currencies, whether it be fiat currencies or you know, and that ties in potentially close to the 1971 when the gold standard was effectively abolished.
Yeah.
So that we're approaching maybe another reset.
Yeah. Oh,
years ago, they basically said we're going to print whatever we fancy. Yeah. In 1971, I'm not sure they realized that this was going to let the sort of the genie out the bag, or out the lamp. I really don't think they thought that this was going to allow financial systems to create so much fiat currency that effectively, you know, it messes things up. Because if you can say, here's $37 trillion and okay, we owe this, but we don't have anything behind it. There's no backing it. It's just our promise.
Yeah.
Instead of fractionally covered by gold in some way, how much gold would you need to fractionally cover $37 trillion of debt?
Fair bit, I'd say.
More than there is in the world, probably, ultimately. Right.
At the current value, Kev, that's assuming it doesn't go to, you know, $50,000 an ounce, then it would probably cover it, if you know what I mean. It's all down to the value of the gold,
which you can tweak. Thinking about it, like the COMEX futures market, like all futures market, yeah, there's hundreds and hundreds of, like, there's, compared to the amount of gold actually in the COMEX vaults, the contract's worth hundreds of times worth what, you know, how much gold there actually is.
Yeah. But
everybody... Now, this is my speculation, right? What happens when everybody wants to settle in gold because the gold price keeps rising?
Not possible.
No, it's not. So there's three things that COMEX can do. They can just settle in the gold they have, and if they run out, there's eligible stockpiles that they can call on where they say, pretty please, will you sell it to us? Or they have to settle at a premium. So what? Yeah. You have a short squeeze set up, you just do.
Either way, this just means the gold price... vis-a-vis the silver price, because if everybody gets on this bandwagon, not everybody's going to have, you know, $30,000 to buy 10 ounces of gold, but most people will have $400 to buy 10 ounces of silver. And that's why we see the silver go exponential as well. And as you rightly said, when is the time to sell one of my gold coins and buy 90 silver coins?
Exactly that.
You know, because my 90 silver coins could be 180 silver coins value in a year's time.
Yeah. There's one other thing I said out, this would be the last, but there's just one other thing I want to ask Charles on, because this has been very interesting. So Rachel Reeves, desperate to raise more tax revenues, you know, is rumoured to be scrapping the cash ISAs or cash individual savings at a moment, you know, where you can put £20,000 a year in a bank or building society, obviously a nice, and you haven't got the, you know, you've got effectively got interest free of tax. So we've seen a panic and rush of savers as they, you know, rush to open up ISAs and whatever that be before any potential clampdown. So what does that raise a question of whether that's actually a good thing, as because people will then maybe push towards investing in stocks and shares, ISAs, and then obviously you're going to have more money going into that. Is it, what are your thoughts on that, Charles, and whether will push people to stocks and shares, ISAs?
Well, the ISA is unique in the world. There's nothing like it. As overtaxed as we are in the UK, it's the one financial product with no strings attached that you just don't have anywhere else. And so you know, that's the first thing, is that you should be, you know, very grateful that we have it. And the Labour government are looking at it now and going, hang on, that's a big whacking source of tax we can come take away. You've got Torsten Bell in government now. And he previously proposed, or at least the Resolution Foundation he chaired, proposed to have $100,000 cap on ISAs anyway. So an ISA cap may be coming down the line. But on that specific question around cash ISAs, personally, I would just scrap interest. I would scrap tax on interest paid on savings, which would just get rid of the need for a cash ISA anyway.
Yeah.
Because I don't think you should be paying tax on interest on savings. I think that's ridiculous. But more importantly, one of the key things people don't understand is that the cash ISA is kind of almost marketed as risk-free.
Yes.
Right? You put your money in and you get your 4% return or whatever. And then you can't lose any of that original money. But you forget the impact of inflation. not like the fake inflation numbers that we get given, the real impact of inflation when you go to the supermarket and, you know, bloody chocolate is now three times what it was a year ago. Yeah, or you want to get bagels and they're twice
that
the
5% interest you've earned on that 20,000 is not going to, you know, that's
no,
not
well, okay, well,
the valuation of the pound.
Let's do this, right? Let's say you put 20 grand in ISA in 2019. Yeah, or 2020, right? Start of the pandemic. And that generated you £1,000 a year in, you know, tax-free interest. And now you've got 25 grand. That 25 grand in 2025, does it have the same purchasing power as 20 grand did in 2020?
No.
Well, the interesting thing about what you said about chocolate is, okay, so chocolate's gone up, right? Mm. But what really annoys me is the size of the bar.
Oh, the shrinkflation, yeah. And the quality reduction as well.
Shrinkflation.
Yeah.
Now, if I want to buy what was for me a chocolate bar before a fruit and nut and dairy milk, I have to buy two.
Because you have a ton of caramel wafers, right? This is a classic one. If you've ever bought them, you know, they do the tea cakes as well, which are nice, but the caramel wafers, they haven't changed the size. There's a one chocolate product that's a fuck off. We're going to be big and giant and Scottish, right?
Yeah.
And they're kind of like a snack biscuit bar. And I had them as a child. I have them occasionally now. But they're now the same length as Mars bars, right? And they used to be, you know, half the size.
Yeah.
Like, it's crazy. Things. Or even like Kit Kats, you know, like Kit Kats are the basic. They're the chocolate of the childhood. And yet you're paying like 25p for each one. It's just a Freddo. I saw 40p for a Freddo.
Freddo's used to be like 18p, didn't they? I can't believe it.
10p originally.
Yeah, you guys aren't old. Freddo's used to be 5p.
Nah, that's a lie. It's a lie.
No, they were.
Your age. No, no.
Freddo's were 5p. That's in the 70s. They went to 10p.
But anyway, look.
I was like, what?
But the basic point is on the ices, right? And we diverge on chocolate prices and shrinkflation and all this thing, is that they are a risk. Because if you put your money into them, you are almost like, okay, over the past year or two, yes, you've beaten inflation, if you believe the official figures, which nobody does. But over the period of sort of, let's see, every 7 years, say the S&P 500, on average, you'll double your money, right? And whether that will continue in the future, we don't know. Past performance, it's not guaranteed of future results, blah, blah, blah. But the basic point is if you put it into a cash ISA, your purchasing power over time is likely going to diminish. If you put it into a stocks
so
and shares ISA,
for these type of investors,
Charles,
for these type of investors, do the same comparison. That in 2020, he bought 20 grand of gold. What would it be worth today? And there would be no tax on it, would there? You would have bought it. It was
you got like a gold ETC, like
but not even a gold ETC. You bought the physical gold.
Well, it's kind of CGT free anyway, isn't it?
Well, 5 years
no
ago,
CGT.
Gold was trading at, let's say, March 2020, around $1,500, and now we're closing in on 3,000. So you would have doubled your money.
Yeah,
simple as that. Okay, if you put it
well, no, actually, you probably wouldn't, because in those five years. How much has the pound depreciated against the dollar?
Oh, indeed. You probably would have made even more.
You would have made more than double, because the reality is you would have been riding the dollar strength as well as, because the dollar, what was the dollar to the pound in March 2020?
Well, at the moment, it's £1 equals $1.26. And
okay.
5 years
so
ago,
so
well,
that,
it's about
that,
the same actually.
Yeah, that's
not
an
new.
Interesting
about
one. So
same.
Effectively,
oh,
let's just say you doubled your money, but then the next question would be, if you put the 20 grand in and use compounding of the annual returns of, say, the S&P 500, what would that 20 grand be worth now, do you think? Would it be as much?
It would be worth 36 grand, maybe. I mean, over the past 5 years.
Pretty similar, give or take. Not
yeah,
far.
All S&P 500. Well, that's yeah. And then, okay, I don't know. Sure, we can pull.
Well, what does that actually physically tell us? Because this is the interesting part, is that pretty much in gold is a fairly good track of inflation. So what has actually happened to our purchasing power? Our purchasing power has halved over those 5 year period.
If you look at the house prices in the UK, or not even just the UK, across the entire Western world, they've gone absolutely ballistic since the pandemic. The house prices haven't increased. The purchasing power of the currency has decreased. And here's a fun one for you. If you had managed to find a way to put your money into a Bitcoin ETF, you would have 10x'd your money in 5 years. That 20 grand would be worth 200 grand. When that particular set of musical chairs ends and everybody starts crying, I don't know.
But
And if you'd put your money in Trump meme coin and left it for a month and then taken out, you would have 100x, no?
Then lost it all. I
and
mean,
lost it all. Yeah, it was a
well,
big rumble.
I will say though, again, not financial advice, but obviously the one thing obvious is when you're going to make a big purchase, whether you're buying a house or a car or something else, then often sacrificing potential gains to stay in cash for that liquidity, that makes sense, right? But throughout history, I mean, then you can always find a reason not to invest, but the S&P 500 since its inception in 1957 has returned on average 11% a year.
Yeah,
You know,
as good
can
as
you
you're going
beat
to get.
11%? And then that also, I mean, the other thing on the small cap world, this is what I say to people, when you're talking about trying to get a better return, when you're investing, you're also sacrificing that 11% to invest in specific stocks. So the upside has to be more than that too.
So the question I pose now, would you want, let's say you are completely investing, not blindly, but you want someone else to do it right now. Would you stick all of your wealth in the S&P 500?
No, I've pretty much cashed out at the start of the year. I think it's going to crash. My personal belief is that the valuations are unsustainable. And when, when DeepSeek came out, right? And there was that wobble for a few days. I think we're in for a correction. Over the longer term, if you're talking about the next 40 years or so,
Exactly.
then yes, you can stay in and not worry about it because it'll just
Yeah,
recover
but
and
that's
go
it.
up.
If you're looking at it from a short-term perspective, then you're probably in the right. But I think if you're going to look at it for a long-term plan, like an investment plan, you could even pound dollar cost average at that
Yeah,
point.
well, I think
That's
a
the whole
lot.
point of it.
I think a lot of people, if you're looking like a really long term, pick a world index, which roughly invested 60% into the US at the moment. And then if the S&P 500 crashes, more of the money gets invested across the wider world. Maybe that's the way forward. But I think the problem is that what can you do? Gold's at record high, Bitcoin record high, all the major indices at record highs, all the tech stocks at record highs. The only things that aren't at record highs are what we talk about all the time, which are the small caps. And so, will there be a pivot into those sort of, growth stocks and small cap value? I think there will be, but when it comes, we don't know.
Yeah, I think it's coming.
Good.
So,
All right.
yeah.
Well, anything to talk about this week? Anything going on in the world? I mean, I've been watching a bit of TV, but I'll come on to those in a minute. Any podcasts or any interesting books being read?
It's been working, to be honest. It's just,
Yeah.
it's been flat. Like we had a bit of a
I
break.
listen to a really good mining podcast, which if anybody wants to look it up, it's good. It's called the Northern Miner Podcast. And there was a thing on it from Henry Lazenby on mining in Darba and the renewed enthusiasm for mining. It also mentioned GMET, I think, in terms of the tungsten and the bans on tungsten. So I think that was good. But I'm looking at some of the other ones now, and I'm up for listening to them when I get a chance. There's one from the PDAC Director of Policy, Jeff Killen, on mining in Canada. And there's also one with our friend Rick Rule on investment strategy and opportunities in nickel, lithium, and PGMs, which he recorded in December. But he actually recorded that at the Mines of Money when he was at the Mines of Money in London, I think. So I haven't listened to that one yet, but I'm going to. But yeah, the podcast is the Northern Miner Podcast, the Northern Miner. Yeah, I found it very interesting actually, so especially as we're in this market.
Yeah, the one I watched on Netflix was a really compelling series. It was American Manhunt, O.J. Simpson. Obviously, it delves into the notorious 1994 murder case of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, and it focuses on really the investigation, the trial, and the sort of the cultural impact of O.J. Simpson's acquittal. And it is fascinating. I mean, you see the whole thing with remember him trying the gloves on and really making an effort. They couldn't get his hands in, and then it was all about the way that the LAPD kind of bungled a lot of the evidence and the way they handled a lot of the evidence at the crime scene, focusing on one particular officer who was inherently racist, a guy called Mark Furman, who's effectively he was the only person who was actually charged in that trial, which is just it's like mind blowing stuff. So that is if you want to learn more about one of the biggest cases in certainly in the last 40 years in Hollywood, then American Manhunt, O.J. Simpson, and then if you like your Scandi noir, you've got a Swedish crime series called the Are Murders, which was released in February as well. That's on Netflix. Great winter scenes from Sweden, and it's a bit of a Scandi noir, but that was excellent. So they're my
You're
two
watching
top
too
picks of the
much
week.
TV. say you need to get out a bit more.
Gotta watch it, mate. I'm out every day. I walk every day as
the
well.
The best TV this week was Everton versus Liverpool.
Oh yeah, it was.
It had everything in it. It had scandal. It had referees being involved far too much. It had people stopping other people celebrating in front of away fans. It had
it was good. I like that meme that I sent you.
98th or 99th minute goal, volley. Superb goal, but
I like the meme I sent you when you remember Liverpool rested all their players to get knocked out of the FA Cup at Plymouth just so they could draw with Everton. I thought that was fantastic.
And then Van Dijk at the end, when he was interviewed, said, "Well, it is Everton's cup final for the season." So that was a real stab in the back, you know, 2-2.
And last game at Goodison, what do you expect? There's going to be some passion in that.
No, it was. It was a very passionate thing, and it was excellent. And then we saw Manchester City capitulate against Real Madrid. They were winning 2-1 with a few minutes to go, managed to lose 3-2. Unbelievable. Literally unbelievable. How they can't just protect the lead now, Manchester City, I don't know. Premier League games, I think. Is it not Manchester City-Arsenal this weekend?
It's Arsenal Leicester tomorrow, isn't it? It
must be a week away then.
Man City, Newcastle in the league.
And Liverpool are playing Wolves, and then Liverpool again are playing Aston Villa in the
big
in
game.
The, week.
The big game is Spurs United on Sunday at on this afternoon at 4:30.
Bottom of the table clash.
Yeah, that's it.
They're fighting for 16th.
Yeah.
Because Everton are joining the party now, so we'll see what happens there.
Yeah, I think we've talked long enough. Anything else? But before we wrap up, no,
not really.
No, I think we're done. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for listening. If you do like what you've heard, please do subscribe. Hit the bell icon for any further notifications of future episodes, and have a great weekend, all.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.